ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय प्रेमातिभरा निर्भिन्ना पुलकंगौ चिनिर्वृता आनन्दा संप्लवे लीनौ नपश्यं उभयं मुने प्रेमातिभर निर्भिन्ना पुलकंगौ चिनिर्वृता आनंद संप्लवे लीनो नापश्यं उभयं मुने प्रेमा लव अतिभारा एक्सेसिव निर्भिन्ना एस्पेशली डिस्टिंग्विश्ड पुलका फीलिंग्स ऑफ हैप्पीनेस Anga, different bodily parts. Ati nirvrita, being fully overwhelmed. Ananda, ecstasy. Samplave, in the ocean of. Lina, absorbed in. Na, not. Apashyam, could see. Ubhayam, both. Mune, O Vyasadev. Translation. O Vyasadev, at that time, being exceedingly overpowered by feelings of happiness, every part of my body became separately enlivened, being absorbed in an ocean of ecstasy. I could not see both myself and the Lord. Purport. Spiritual feelings of happiness and intense ecstasies have no mundane comparison. Therefore, it is very difficult to give expression to such feelings. We can just have a glimpse of such ecstasy in the words of Sri Narad Muni. Each and every part of the body or senses has its particular function. After seeing the Lord, all the senses become fully awakened to render service unto the Lord, because in the liberated state, the senses are fully efficient in serving the Lord. As such, in that transcendental ecstasy, it so happened that the senses became separately enlivened to serve the Lord. This being so, Narad Muni lost himself in seeing both himself and the Lord simultaneously. So now we're going through Narad Muni's transcendental upliftment here, his perfection. That in this time, we see he left the house, and so then he came to perfection here. Actually, he came to perfection in the last verse. Perfection means the stage of bhava, or one is liberated or freed from material contamination. So that was attained just previously. So now we see is that these ecstasies now are starting to overwhelm him. And in this, then, he is becoming completely absorbed. So absorbed that he cannot, you know, see himself, see the Lord like this. So Prabhupada points out these ecstasies, then, they are not... One cannot describe them really compared to other things here. So many things you can describe with analogies, and you get a fairly decent idea. But here, the ecstasies, this is experience, and you just don't have that experience here. Tattva, you can always give an analogy, because the form of what's here, the form of what's there will be the same. The reflection in the river is the same. Right, the tree on the land, the tree in the water, it's the same. You know, some difference, therefore the analogy always has its shortcomings. But it's close enough that you can get a very good idea. But when it comes to rasa, then it becomes more difficult, because then you're dealing with experience. And experience, you cannot get the experience from the tree in the water like the tree on the land. It just doesn't happen. It's not possible in any way, shape, or form. You can get a glimmer of an idea also, an analogy, but now the analogies become the disparity between them, the analogy and the reality is very great. Well, in the tattva, it can be close enough to really get the point across. So here, we see Prabhupada doesn't even try. You know, it doesn't bother, because it just can't be explained. The difficulty comes is that experience is actually what the living entity is looking for. And in this world, then that experience is connected to gaining something that we've mentally concocted that's going to make us happy. That's how the material world functions. We decide that we have to be happy here, and we have heard about someone else's happiness. So then we take that and either accept it for ourselves, or we make our own adjustments. We personalize our mental concoctions. Right? It means we want it like that, but with this particular twist or angle or addition or subtraction, something is there. So then, attaining that, then there is a moment of happiness that we have gained. So that gain, then, is our what we're trying to get. But that gain is something that you've gained, but it's based on time. So it's in the future, so you have that inspiration that you may get it. And then when you got it for the moment, then there's great happiness, but then it passes. That's the difficulty with the material. So you're dealing with time. While in transcendental ecstasy, there is no time. So you're not dealing with passion and ignorance. You're only dealing with goodness. So then, if the happiness you could gain out of that you gain in something in the material world was there before you got it and was there after you had it, and then you could start to get close, because there's no passion or ignorance. So that's why you can't compare the two. You know, it just doesn't match, because being a spot in time, and it's a spot, it's just you only gain it at a moment. That moment, that is the moment of happiness. You know? And then, so there's a feeling that's there, something that comes up for that moment. And then after that, it remains for a little bit, because such a strong impression on the mind, that happiness that you gained, then creates you talk, you may be very, either, you know, bewildered or stunned or laughing or in ecstasy or crying or whatever may be the emotional reaction that came, that will then remain for a little time, but the actual feeling of that happiness of having gained it is already gone. Because it's only a moment in time as it passes the window of your consciousness, right? That's it. You know, you're racing to the finish line, you know, there's that anticipation that you're going to win, you cross the line, there's that moment of that happiness, then after that you simply talk about what you had, right? You're not actually experiencing it anymore. So that's material happiness. That's why ecstasy can't be compared to it, because it just doesn't, you know, means, in other words, because we're discussing the tattva, we can elaborate on it. But the actual feeling itself, the experience, that can't be described. So, therefore, from that, then we use our intelligence to understand is that what we have attachment for in this world, we obviate that attachment by contemplating its uselessness. Right? That's the system. Right? As long as we think it's good, then we will always be hankering for it and lamenting for its loss, and we will be happy for the moment that it's gained, because of that mental concoction that this has to give us happiness, right? So if that's given up by intelligence, right, it means ignorance is bliss, right? Even the karmis will say this, because as soon as you add intelligence to the equation, somehow or another something is lost, right? As soon as intelligence comes in, that uninhibited happiness somehow or another now has an angle on it that, well, it's not actually that great. So then generally what happens on the material platform is that when the knowledge about the thing becomes too great, that the knowledge overwhelms the happiness you get from it, then, because we have faith in material happiness, we will just switch to another form of happiness that we have no knowledge about. Does that make sense? We will just switch it to another one where there is no intellectualizing on it, and we can purely function on the mental platform of mental concoction of that this will give me happiness. And then as soon as then we start to intellectualize on it and observe it, and we are objective about it, then we start to do, you know, doubts come up, and then slowly, slowly it goes down, and then when it gets where the, how you say, the returns are less than the expectation, then again we look for a new thing that we know nothing about. Understand? So that's the process we're going through in the material world. We're always trying to find that situation in which that happiness we know nothing about. You know, just like something's going on, everybody's very happy, and then somebody comes in who's not on the, you know, same page as everyone else and makes a comment about the situation. And then everyone goes, "Ah, you ruined that. Wait, it was so nice. Why'd you do that?" You know, like that. You know, he was just, "Oh, I don't know. I was just, you know, I just said what was there." And everybody else is very unhappy because now you've brought intelligence into the equation. So that's material ecstasy, right? It has its limitation. So here the happiness is so great that it can't be described. And we see is that it's not just something in the heart. It extends to also the senses. In material happiness, the senses are the medium through which you gain something that your mental concoction works over. But it itself does not have any ecstasy. They are not themselves enlivened. Does that make sense? Because on the material platform, we decide, okay, if I do this, it will be nice. Just like we say, if I eat this preparation, it will be nice. So we put that preparation onto the tongue, and because we're getting the sensation that we've decided will be nice, then we say, this is nice. But it's not that the tongue thinks it's nice. You understand? That's the point. The tongue doesn't care. You can put anything on the tongue and it'll just tell you what it is. It doesn't decide if it's good or bad. Right? That's all. It's just a machine that distinguishes between six tastes. Right? That's all. The mind decides, is that taste good or not? Like you have a kid. Somehow or another, they've decided that, you know, some preparation is not good. Right? You know, like let's say you take Corella, right? We don't even have to say a kid, but whatever. We'll just, to give the benefit of the doubt, we'll leave it as a kid. So, for some reason, they've eaten some Corella and they didn't have a good experience, right? Right? The point is experience, it's not the taste. Right? Because Lord Chaitanya loved bitter, so it can't be all that bad. God likes it, it can't be too bad. Right? He's the enjoyer, so, you know, so if he likes it, it can't be too off the mark. But somehow the experience that the kid had was bad. Right? It's not intelligence. That's the whole point. Is it's not intelligence. So they had a bad experience with it. So therefore, they will never eat it. Then you tell them, no, this, that. And then you can't convince them. If sometime you can somehow or another, they have a good experience. You know? You prepare it in a way they can't tell what it is. They may take, oh, this is very nice. Right? How many times have we heard of that situation, right? Devotees are going, wow, this is really great, you know, what is it? And then when the cook tells them what it is, then that's it, no one will touch it. I've heard so many equations, like there's a whey, right? Whey somehow or another just has a bad reputation, right? Huh? Yeah, whey. It's just no one wants to deal with it, you know? And I remember one cook, he was so expert, he figured out a way to make a nectar drink out of whey that everybody loved. And they were all raving about it, talking. And he asked, what is it? What's in there? And as soon as he mentioned whey, that's it. Everyone turned off. No one had touched it. Even though they tasted it was great. But in their mind, no, whey is bad. Even though they taste it, it's fine. So that's why intelligence is so important to cut the material. But at the same time, intelligence won't help you on understanding the spiritual. Right. So that's the position here. So now this goes beyond now the senses, so and that also then points it's not the sense, it's how you interpret it. The tongue thought it was, you know, it figured out it was it had these combinations, and then the mind interpreted it as good. But as soon as the mind decided it wasn't good, then even though the tongue, it didn't matter for the tongue. It didn't change the taste by knowing its way. Now the mind interprets it different, so the sense isn't inspired. Right? You don't want to engage that sense. So here we can see is that the transcendental ecstasy goes into another realm because the sense itself is enlivened. The sense itself desires to serve, to be in contact with the Lord. So this is some beyond our experience. That's why prema is the end of the line for the material body as far as spiritual ecstasy goes. You can't handle beyond that. That's the second stage of love of Godhead, is prema. Beyond that, the third to the eighth stage can only be experienced in a spiritual body. Because here he's saying merged into the ocean of spiritual ecstasy, and each of the senses becomes enlivened. So he's in one ocean with all the senses enlivened. So the body can handle that. But when it goes beyond this, beyond it, into the third stage, each sense is in an ocean. And each one is functioning and experiencing separate from the other. Right? Here it's just they're all enlivened, but it's not specific. Does that make sense? You're in the ocean and everything's enlivened. That's nice. But beyond that, each one is perceivable as completely in ecstasy, separate from the other, and each is in its own ocean. That the material body can't handle. It just fall apart. Therefore, then beyond this stage, then it's only experienced in the spiritual platform. Plus, they don't even, you know, they even don't refer to it. They just say they're happy. You know, they don't specifically say what's going on. Because then it's beyond even the realm of, you know, addressing it a bit according to the philosophy, like that. Okay. So here's the thing is that when one sees sense objects, then one becomes enlivened to engage the sense in that sense object. But it's the specific one. You see something to eat, then the inspiration that the tongue will be involved, then is there. But because the Lord, He is, everything is Him, and everything is interchangeable. You know, that point that he can eat with his eyes, or he can smell with his skin, or that. So that means seeing the Lord, that means whatever aspect you're dealing with the Lord, any one of your senses could serve. Does that make some sense? Right? Because the Lord, he functions like that. Every part of his body is interchangeable. Therefore, then the devotee, when he comes in contact, any part of his body is interchangeable also. Therefore, just seeing the Lord, it enlivens all the senses. Or smelling the Lord, it enlivens all the senses. Or tasting the Lord, it enlightens all the senses. So that's what's very special here, is that coming in contact with the Lord, it's a completely different experience. It's nothing to do with anything here. So this always has to be kept in mind. Means one will do something if he has a goal. If there's a goal in mind, one acts. So now, if we think about it, if you go back some years, then because the only goal was love of Godhead, then all the activities were only in pursuance of love of Godhead. And all of our taste in devotional service was in relation to those activities to attain love of Godhead. Right? So now one has to see is one still keeping that same goal in mind? Or is that the ultimate goal, but there's all kinds of other goals in between? But the focus may or may not be on the ultimate, but it may be on others. Therefore, happiness may be gotten. So therefore, our happiness goes into other areas. Right? Still connected with devotional service, but it's just reverse the priority. Right? Therefore, one gets distracted. So one has to see that that ultimate goal is kept in mind, because whatever activity you do, it's based on a goal, right? Short term or long term. Is that you may have many short term goals to get to a long term goal, but you're only functioning because you have a goal, right? So attaining your goal is where you'll get your taste, right? That's where you get the taste. Okay? Does that make sense? So unless your goals are set properly, then the taste will not be spiritual. It will be material. So that's why one always has to remember that this is what is available, this kind of transcendental ecstasy that goes beyond anything here. Because whatever you get here, if you think about it, really just, you know, analyze it, it's nothing really special. It doesn't really give you any lasting happiness, right? Things that really last, if you think about it, push comes to shove, is the association of devotees, you know, the times that have been there in, you know, hearing and discussing the scriptures, or festivals like that, preaching events, you know. Of course, there's the memorable experiences with prasadam, also transcendental. Then, but much of the time you'll find that's because of the association and the situations, you know, that surround it, as opposed to just the taste, right? Like that. And chanting, kirtan, or one's own japa. If you see, it goes back to those, because those are eternal. Those actually, the method, the attraction to them, the attachment to them, the performance of them are non-different. They're all spiritual. Everything else other than these are to assist those. So they do have some, they are dovetailed mundane activities. Right? So they're all part of this. So the more you see them in connection with these, then the more transcendental happiness you get from it. And the more it is the material aspect of it that we like because of our conditioned nature, then the more or less, then we may find the more transient is our happiness. Just like, let's say, okay, we take cooking. Cooking's part of deity worship, so it can very easily be put in with worshiping the deity, which is a transcendental or eternal activity. Now, the inspiration to cook now can be that this is being cooked for the deities, and so that becomes the prominent aspect in the experience or in the consciousness. So then afterwards, that's what's remembered, is that happiness of cooking for the deity. So then that won't give you problem later. If you have some difficulty cooking at some time or have a bad experience, that experience won't be lost. Understand? Because it's different from the cooking. The cooking was simply the medium. Now let us say the cooking, we are by nature a cook, and so we like the various techniques of cooking and the elements of it, and mixing and matching of various items and methods and you know, different elements, you know, you can, how you cut it, how you present it, what order you put it. I mean, it's unlimited if you're into the subject, what you can do with the medium. And so if that's the more important, and that it's very nice because I love cooking, and now it's great because now I can cook for the Lord, then you will get a taste out of it because it's being done for the Lord. So you will definitely be happy. But if you run into any difficulties, you can't get the ingredients, that you don't have the proper time, you don't have the facilities to prepare how you want to prepare like this, or you're preparing for people who, you know, don't appreciate good cooking, then those things start to weigh on the happiness you gain from cooking. And then if at some point you have a really bad experience, or they add up enough, then you may reject the idea of cooking. And with that goes all the happiness you got from it. Right? Even in the past. And then it'll take time for you to forget the pain, and then all you remember is the happiness again, right? You know, that's a normal thing. You know, it's just like 20, 30 years later, you know, you sit around and laugh about things that caused you so much problem in those days. You know, you sit around with devotees and say, hey, remember when you tossed me out of the temple and did that and that, wasn't that, you know, and that, and the, whatever, you know, like that. But at the time, it wasn't. It was not a happy moment. But later on, you just laugh at, you know, how much we are absorbed and craziness of youth or, you know, passion and, you know, all these different things. Eventually you come back, okay, not so bad. But then it's coming back to the interaction with the devotees, the situations, the service. So still it comes back. What remains is simply the transcendental connection. Does that make some sense? So if we can analyze this, if we analyze this very nicely, then we see is that it's just a matter of the priority. It's not what's being done, because we don't have another alternative other than our conditioned nature to engage in the Lord's service, right? It's not that we decide, okay, you know, material body and the conditioned nature is useless, so from this moment I'll simply use my spiritual form, right? And at that moment then poof, you know, then sitting there is, you know, some resident of Vrindavan who then goes about, you know, squeegeeing the temple or, you know, doing whatever they were doing before that moment. But it's, so that option's not there. So the conditioned nature is what we have. So then it's just a matter of the priority. Is it the pleasing of Krishna? And then along with pleasing Krishna, my senses are pleased and, you know, and it's being done in the realm and the medium I can use are the medium of my conditioned nature. Then it becomes very easy, because that's all it is which is the priority. The activity remains the same. So it's a matter of whether the short-term goals become the prominent and the long-term may be kind of faded in the distance, or the long-term is the actual goal and then the short-term are simply seen as process. Does that make sense? Process means your method to get there. Now, you may have so many short-term goals, but they're all goals within the process to get to the ultimate goal. Does that make sense? It's just like, okay, so we're going to cook. So therefore, then the first thing we have to do is make a menu. Okay, so that's a goal. So then you get that goal. Now, if you just stop there, then that's the end of your part in that process. Right? But now if you go out and, okay, now we'll get the ingredients. So now getting ingredients is a goal. But if you stop there, then you're just somebody who does marketing. Or the other is you're just somebody who make, you know, plans the thing and tells others to do. Then, okay, then after that, then you have to cut everything up, prepare, get your pots, get all your everything together that you're going to do. Now once you got that, if you stop at that point, then you're a kitchen assistant. Right? But then if you go to the next stage, you actually cook it. Right? Then that goal, and it's cooked. If you stop there, then you're a cook. Right? Now if you take the next thing, and then you serve it out, you offer it, and you stop there, then you're pujari. Take the next step, you serve it, and you're, you know, a waiter, you're serving prashad. Right? But if you see, if you're doing the whole thing, then the whole point is you're trying to please the Lord and the devotees. So then that aspect, devotional service, then it includes all those small goals. So they're actually just part of the process. They're just process of devotional service. So then one keeps going to that longer term. Otherwise, if you set your sights at the short term... Sorry. Just let you know that's what it's called. Tongue twisters. Set your sights at the short term. Okay. So then you may lose sight of the long term. That's why it's always one keeps in mind is that the long term is that pleasing of Krishna and coming to the transcendental platform. The taste that's gotten there is beyond anything that can be gained here. You know, so it says that one gets to that point, then he feels there's no greater gain. Right? Krishna mentions this in the Gita, is that one who has come to this platform, he feels that there's no greater gain than this. Because there isn't anything great. You have Krishna. You can't gain better than that. And having Krishna, that happiness, right? You've gained something. You're happy. So that gain's eternal. And that taste is eternal. So we always have to keep in mind that this is actually what we're here for, right? We're not here for other things. That's our actual purpose. Okay. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Sometimes we have like that. We get familiar. You were mentioning in the beginning, about getting familiar. We get to know about somebody, something, and then we lose interest. Also, but there is also another aspect of it. When we know how to deal with that familiarity. For example, there is a really culture. There is a thing that there's a distance kept always, so that familiarity doesn't happen. For example, the disciple, the guru, means that someone is disciple gets too close, then the relationship builds over, it becomes like a friend, and they start to use the good and use the offense is coming up and all these things. So what is the understanding of the two things, that familiarity and
okay, how does one avoid familiarity? Because as soon as familiarity is there, one drops the endeavor. Is the same thing as always keep the goal in mind. Means formality is there because there is something to go through to get to a point. So then formality means there's sensitivity, there's care. You know, familiarity means you don't care. So then if you always keep your goal in mind, then familiarity, how will it rise? You know, so then familiarity won't come with the spiritual master, because the point is you're supposed to come to the point of transcendental love of God. So if you don't have that, then you haven't completed the process. You can't become familiar. Right? So then you won't be, that won't be a problem. The difficulty is we're so used to short-term goals that that's how we function. And even if we have someone, if somebody, you talk about someone who has a vision or this or that, it's still a long-term, short-term goal. It's still material. Because anything material is short-term. So you see someone with a longer-term goal, then they have, you know, a goal of, you know, freeing their country or establishing a company or establishing some other thing or gaining some particular, you know, perfecting a particular branch of knowledge or theory or that. So sometimes they keep this their whole life, you know. The person had this when they were in their teens, and then when they're 60, 70 years old, they're recognized, they get their Nobel Prize for something and like this. So then that person will be considered long-term vision, long-term goal. But still, because this material is still short term, because it will be gone. And since the soul is eternal, then the goal has to be eternal. So the more you can put it back, then both the farther you can go and the bigger things you can do. Right? Means if you want to do bigger service, you have to have a longer vision. Right? Let's say you want to build the big temple, that's going to take more than a couple of days. So that takes some longer vision. You know, you want to go down to the front gate and buy some ice cream, then it doesn't take as great a vision to do. You know, I had a vision. You know, I was eating ice cream. Like that, you know? Like that. So one can do that, but still, the something else that takes longer. Then you can do that service. If all you can do is figure out ice cream, it's then, you know, okay, he says, yeah, so build this big temple. Yeah, great. Hey, can we discuss this over some ice cream? You know, so then one can't get very far. So that's the whole thing, is the farther back you put your goal, then everything in between that simply becomes your process. Yeah, focus. So that's the thing, because if you have short-term focuses, then they're never in a straight line, right? You can only put things in a straight line if something on the other side of them is in line with that, right? It means you have an ultimate goal, then if that's your goal, then everything that you plan will be in a straight line between them, you know? And even if it is a tangent, it will be a planned tangent. You know how to go off and how to come back. It won't just happen. You won't be bewildered. But if you don't, then short term it's okay, it's here, and then you get tired of the ice cream or they don't have any more, then you got to put it into something else, and then it will move around. So the focus is not so great. So if you focus it on something long, everything in between will come in line with that. You know, that's the meaning of dovetailing. If you have an ultimate goal, then anything in between of your material desire becomes brought in line with that, and because it's in that line, it becomes spiritualized. Right? It means you connect something to the electric line, it becomes electrified. But if you put it, you know, just a little bit away from that line, it gets no electricity. So that's the thing, is that what's in line between where you are at present and your ultimate goal of pleasing Krishna, then anything that you do in between will be connected to that. And then you'll get spiritual result. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Purification, yeah. Purification is a temporary goal because the soul is pure. So what happens is that the soul's consciousness becomes impure by identifying with the material energy. We think we're the body, we think we're the material, we're the mind, the intelligence, ego. Because of that, we identify with that. So what is happening is we have to purify our identification with it. So the processes and methods that we do, it's not that they themselves are what's wonderful. It's the consciousness that's raised. That's why anything other than spiritual endeavor actually is not in itself purifying. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, means purification means Brahma Bhuta. Means this is the platform that he is on now. You reach that, that's called perfection. Then this transcendental ecstasy is normal. That's the normal platform. Now, because the spiritual senses of the living entity are covered by the material energy, therefore they're dulled. So interactions in rasa becomes very dull, and because it's covered, then the attraction is to sensual or emotional rasa rather than transcendental rasa. The function is the same. Rasa is one entity, whether it's spiritual, emotional, or sensual. The process is the same. But the difference is that what you want to gain from it, the taste you want to gain is different. The rasa that you want to taste is different, but the method's the same. So when the senses become purified, then one can appreciate transcendental engagement of the senses. So the result that you get is transcendental. So you get transcendental taste from service. Okay, it's a very good point. How does one become pessimistic about material enjoyment but not lose one's enthusiasm to perform activity? Because that's the first thing that comes up. Because impersonalism is the next stage after fruitive work. We're inspired to perform an activity because of the mundane result we'll get in the way of enjoyment or position or fame or, you know, something. Then when we see the uselessness of that fame or that enjoyment or wealth, then the next thing is impersonalism. We just give it up. And then when we find that from impersonalism we don't get happy, then we go for voidism. So that cycle is, the living entity just keeps going through. So that is the whole point of the culture. That's why culture is so important. The impersonalist functions with philosophy and no culture. Therefore, then they get frustrated and they go into voidism. Right? Because voidism means anger. Right? But nowadays, anger it's the thing. Right? You go to a psychologist, the main thing they do is it means you're going to the psychologist because you're unhappy. You're unhappy because of frustration. Right? And frustration creates anger. So the modern idea is you increase that anger, you know? You bring out the rage. Yeah, blame it on others, put it on everyone else, make yourself feel good that you're okay, right? And it works. It's always worked. I mean, they say it's a modern thing, but that's what Hitler used in World War II. The Germans lost, and they lost because they lost. That's all. It wasn't that they were, you know, for whatever reason, they just lost the war. But Hitler came along and said, actually, you didn't really lose the war. you were cheated out of your gain, your victory, because you are far superior than anybody else, and your endeavors were better than everybody. But because the Jews sold out to the enemy like that, they suck all the money and they gave all the information, therefore you lost. So now, simply you take courage in yourself, you push forward, and we get rid of these Jews, and anything like them. Then throw in a few gypsies and this and that along the way. Then the glory of Germany is back. So their whole thrust was built on this principle of rage, and throwing their rage onto others. And you see the result. It doesn't make peace. It doesn't make peace with yourself. It doesn't make... Yeah, and then you lose again. This time it definitely couldn't have been the Jews, right? Definitely can't blame it on them. Yes? Who?
Bali.
Oh, okay. The Lord or the Lord's abode? Same, it's the same. Why did he give him the Sutala plan? Why did he give him the Sutala planet? Because his position to take up as Indra wasn't coming until the next millennium. Bali Maharaj, I think, is either the next Indra or the one after this. So until then, because that's his place, Sutala was his planet. Yeah, but his place became more heavenly than Indra's place. If you go to Indra's place, it won't be as good as Sutala when Bali Maharaj was sitting there. While he's there, it's better. Like that. So, yeah, no, it means, but even if the demons aren't devotees, Bali Maharaj is a devotee, and the demons do their demon thing, right? It's just like, dogs bark and they're nasty and they, do all the things. So even if they're associated with, they're the dog of a devotee, they're still going to do their dog things, So the demons there are still going to do their demon things, but they're connected with the devotee. So then they may get some benefit. If they render some service that's in connection with the Lord, they'll get benefit. But in any case, that's a normal thing. Kings deal with the people on their own level and try to elevate them as they can, because you have to start somebody from where they are. So that's why even sometimes the kings are sometimes criticized because their citizens are bad. Like Shalva, then when came to an argument, then it was pointed out, well, hey, you're the king of the Madrakas, right? And the Madrakas, it's famous, everyone knows that the women there move around with any man like that, so therefore you're the king of these people, you take 1/6 of their sin, therefore you also are sinful like them, so that aspect will always be there. Or Gandhari's father, and Shakuni, the brother, because they were the kings of Afghanistan, Gandhar. So the Gandhari people, they were not known for their pure habits. They're still not known for their pure habits. The same people were there before, just that the kings knew how to manage them. They were more powerful than them, so they could manage them. So they stay the same. So the demons will still be demons. But they, by Bali Maharaj's arrangement, they will follow the rules nicely, like that. Don't do anything that's outside of their rights to do. And then by his association, then more and more of them may come in contact with devotional service, may become devotees. But if they don't, but at least they're on the material path, they'll move forward. Spiritually, maybe not, the material. That's why the slow path is not considered so great. Because you can be on the slow path, you can be moving forward, but because you don't have the long-term goal of Krishna consciousness, you may get distracted by some other thing and then go backwards. So even though by karma they're progressing, but because their goal is not to go back to Godhead, as soon as they've gained the heavenly planets or material enjoyment, they'll stop there. They won't go further. You know, like we described before, the person who just does the shopping, he stops there. Right? He didn't make the menu, and he won't cut the vegetables. So he only deals with his little window. Like that. So someone who has that bigger, then they'll move forward. That's the danger of just, that's good enough. Well, at least they're doing this nicely. You know? Isn't he a bit in Maya? You know, he's just with his family all the time and all that. Well, at least now, you know, his family unit's working nicely and they're not criticizing the devotees and you know, feeling bad towards the movement and all that. Okay, he was a temple president or GBC or that, and he was doing big service and now he's doing nothing. But at least his family is not criticizing. Okay, that's nice. That's moving forward. His family has moved forward from his neglecting them completely because of his service. Now he gives them time. But it's still short term unless he shows them that there's something beyond. Yeah, otherwise, then okay, they're nice. You know, it says an ordinary devotee is one who's born in the family of devotees but doesn't take up seriously Krishna consciousness. They're devotees. But they're not; they're just ordinary. Until they take initiation, decide, yes, this process that Narad Muni went through here, Shraddha, Sadhu, Sangha, Bhajana, then it gets serious. Then the Lord recognizes this person as a serious devotee. Just being born in the family of devotees, they're automatically devotees. They're recognized as devotees. But they become serious devotees when they take up the process. Like that. Otherwise, then it's just sentiment. And sentiment at any moment can be moved because it's experience. The only thing it takes to move sentiment is a bad experience. Right? That's all it takes. But intelligence, because there's a longer goal and one understands what you're dealing with because you analyze the process, a bad experience comes up, you just see as an obstacle to work around or to overcome, to get to your goal. So that's why intelligence is so much more important. If your sentiment, you can connect to the Lord directly and skip the whole middle stuff, that's great. That's the first recommendation. You just surrender to the Lord completely and develop love for Him. You become attached to Him. You don't need all this intellectualizing in between. That's why I said the gopis, they weren't big philosophers. They weren't great yogis. They weren't, you know, knew the scriptures or knew the rituals or no, none of that. They just simply had affection for Krishna. Because that affection was there, that developed into attachment, then became love of God. So that's what you want to do. But the point is if that affection is shorter than that, then it may get distracted unless intelligence is applied. Because intelligence can keep you on the path to get to that ultimate where it goes again back to sentiment. So intelligence is simply the bridge between our mundane sentiment and therefore endeavor and our spiritual sentiment and therefore endeavor. That's why at this point, intelligence is dropped. Mundane intelligence has run its course of usefulness. Now it's simply spiritual intelligence, how to perform your particular service. But the bridge has been made. Once you cross that bridge into Brahma-Bhuta, the intelligence has done its job. Like that. And so then it's again back to pure sentiment. You know? Like that. So that's the yeah. Does that make sense? Was your question fully answered before? Okay. Yeah. 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 No, devotees drop devotional services because many times of that long-term goal is not seen. Like that. And that's by association. You know, if the association has that vision, then one's own vision will be extended. That's why association is so important. Here, this whole point of this is Narad Muni's, this whole exercise, is Narad Muni's association is what created his fortune. That's why Prabhupada says, I made your fortune. You know, devotees, a lot of times, I remember, you know, new devotees sit around, and when you come to that verse about the four kinds of devotees that surrender, right, you know, then always were the jnani. Yes, you know, I was really looking for something, and like this. We were never the artarti or jigyasu, right, you know, like that. Always the jnani, yes, you know, yes, this. But Prabhupada said he made our fortune. You know, we were just rotting there. And then the devotees come along with their kirtan and their prasad and their festivals and all that. And then, so he made the fortune. So by that, then that association takes us. So that's why association is the root of the whole thing. By good association, then Shraddha comes. So we say it as Shraddha, Sadhu, Sangha, Bhajana, Kriya like this. But in actuality, until there's Shraddha, I mean, until there's sadhu sangha, you can't start the whole process. Because it's through the devotees that the seed of devotional service, or bhakti, comes. So that seed being planted by the devotees, then faith comes. But where it started was that. So it has to be, bhakti has to be, is only started from bhakti. So association, therefore, becomes the most important. That's why the criticizing of devotees of the use of the principle of using rage is very detrimental to devotional service. It has nothing to do with devotional service. Even material life, it's not. Because anger, it says for a king, he has to give up the 10 forms of sense pleasure and the 8 forms of anger. Because the sense pleasure, he'll just get into trouble and create a miserable situation for himself. But the vices that come from anger can even create death. Because anger comes so much, you'll do something that's so stupid. Like that. So therefore, anger is considered the most destructive of all the vices. Like that. And that all comes from greed. So if anger is there so much, means greed is there so much. So if someone can have so much rage, means there's so much greed is there for it to be based, because it has to be fueled from somewhere. You can't fuel anger from nothing. Anger has to come from frustration. Frustration has to come from desire. And you can only be really angry if the desire is so great. And to create so much anger means it's beyond the culture, right? Civilized society means you may be angry, but it still functions within this culture. So when it goes to the point where it can't even function, to be expressed, it can't function being expressed through the culture, means it has to be based on greed. You know, this is just, you know, it's just the way the material nature works. So as a process, it's not good. The thing what's being missed is that commiserating with the person, trying to understand their bad experience is, what is the situations that disturb them, that's fine. But that's association. But that should be between the persons. But throwing it onto rage means you're throwing it onto a third party. That means actually the person trying to help the disturbed person, those two of them don't have a relationship. Therefore, they have to use a third party as the medium of bonding. But it should be in real relationship is the bonding can happen directly. Right? And you can have a third party, which is Krishna. Krishna, Guru, the Vaishnavas. But it goes through them. It doesn't go separate to them. It means here you have the psychologist, you have the patient, and then rage is the third. But both of them focus on that. It's not going through their relationship. But with the devotees, Krishna is the goal, but that relationship's going through those devotees. So they also taste their relationship with Krishna. Yeah, my Shastra. So it's a different principle. Very different principle. So that's why, except for the Vedic psychology, they don't actually know what they're dealing with. Because you can go to any you take the top PhD world authority on psychology and ask them, what is the mind? Or what is the intelligence? What does it work? They can't say. There is not one in the world that can say. Because they didn't create it, so they don't know what it is. They're observing it, they're students of the mind, but they're not masters. So the scriptures are written by the person who made the mind, so he tells you what it is. Right? All it does is accept and reject. That's all. And so then what value system you place on it, it can accept and reject anything. So not knowing these things, then they accept and reject things that are, reject things that are favorable, accept things that are unfavorable. Therefore, even though it seems in the beginning to give some temporary relief, it doesn't. So that's why it's very important to function within the Vedic philosophy and all that. You know, therefore the culture has to be there. That's what we started off with, is that, you know, the philosophy, so when you have frustration with your desire, it goes to impersonalism, which means to give up connection with the material world. But the impersonalist has given up the culture, right? So therefore they're stuck with mental speculation. They give up religion. And the fruit of labor, you know, the pious fruit of activist, they have religion, you know, so they have sentiment, but they have no philosophy. Yes, ourself is that. Yeah, that's a very good example. So the attraction is there for sex, so therefore when we find the fault in that and reject it, then we become angry with the women because they're the cause of it, but they're not the cause of it. Means the point is that for women, sex is intimacy. That's all. It's a closeness. For man, it's sense gratification. Because the women, their field is sense gratification. So that means man has different fields. He can be involved in sensual activities or not. Women, their field is senses. So there's not a time when they're not in it. So it's an experience of senses, emotions, or intellectual, or transcendent. It's always experience. So mind is the prominent. Yes, feeling. So therefore, for them, it's just whether the feeling is more intimate or less intimate. So the activity itself is not actually what's important. If intimacy can be gained by not by physical contact, that's fine. Or if intimacy has to be gained by physical contact, that'll be used as the medium. But it's sense gratification is not the goal. So if you look at that, so therefore the man's desire for sex is not the women's fault. Right? It's the man's mental concoction that dealing with women will fulfill their sexual need, it will fulfill their desire. That by seeing them, by touching them, by embracing them, that they will gain something from it. But when the form of the woman, there's nothing there because it is a reflection on the water. So there's nothing there. You can touch it, you can talk with it, you can do whatever you want with it. You don't get anything out of it. There's no fulfillment. That's why one keeps going more and more and more and more, because it's just, you figure, well, if I can just, you know, see the girl, I'll be happy. And then you see the girl, well, if I could just talk to her, I'll be happy. And then you talk to her, well, if I could just touch her, I'll be happy. Well, if I could just kiss her, I'll be happy. Well, if I could touch her more intimately, I'll be happy. Well, if I get all her clothes off, I'll be happy. It just keeps going because you can't fulfill it. His first point is that I'll be happy if I get this. But he gets that. It's all mental concoction. So that's the whole thing. So it's not the women. It's the man's attachment to the idea that women can fulfill his desires, his emotional or his sensual desires, when there's no question of it. It just doesn't. Means the senses and emotions can only be fully pleased in connecting with Krishna, because he is the enjoyer. So he is senses. He is rasa. Yeah, so being rasa, therefore everything is there in him. So connecting with him, then the senses, the emotions, the mind, the entire, everything becomes fulfilled. So that's the whole point. Therefore, one can use as a medium these things. But unless Krishna is connected to it, then one will get nothing out of it. Now, if you connect Krishna to it, you remove it. That's why the devotee, it appears that he's still performing karmakanda activities. That's why even the scriptures that are based on karmakanda, we still use. Like, we'll still use Manusmita for our culture, or the Pancharatric texts for aspects of our culture, because we're still going to deal with our conditioned nature. But because it's done with knowledge, you remove the attachment for it, right? As long as one is doing it without knowledge, then one thinks it's this. Okay, he does and he does whatever he wants with this girl and he's frustrated. So then the natural conclusion is this girl. So that girl, she'll be great. You know, but after going through many, many like this, then he becomes frustrated. Ah, then it's just women. You know, they're all useless because they can't fulfill my desire. Because I have decided that they're going to fulfill my desire. Right? There's no question. That's like saying, you know, it's like, how you say? I'm really thirsty and so therefore, you know, warm oil is going to fulfill my thirst. It can never fulfill. There's no question that oil and your thirst has anything to do with each other. So our desire to be fulfilled in senses and emotion can't be fulfilled in women. It can't. It just doesn't exist. Our senses and emotions can be reposed in Krishna. So therefore, that anger towards them doesn't there. Of course, the women who, they know that this is men's illusion, right? They know that their body is attractive and creates desire in men, and they know that particular parts of their body create more than others. So then they accentuate that and do that to agitate and create a situation in which they are considered more desirable, because desirable means need, needs means gain and safety. So it's simply a natural part of their psyche to create security for themselves. So in that way, then they're party to this thing, is that therefore the chaste women, they know, it's just like you take the chaste, you take the prostitute, you take the chaste woman, they both are functioning on the same platform, is that they know what creates attraction, what doesn't. So the chaste girl therefore covers and makes sure that those aspects aren't seen. Well, the prostitute knows by showing that's what gets the work done. Therefore, you see in that there's a connection between. That's why you can see many times that the prostitutes, when they come in contact seriously with devotional service, or those persons who can, you know, show them the correct path, in a moment they can become the most chaste, because they know what makes the most unchaste, so they just reverse it. It's the ones in between that are uneducated, therefore their purpose is to be chaste, but because they don't know the field, they do activities that are actually unchaste and create attraction. You know? So, yeah. So the point is that then the person blames the women because of that anger, but it's actually, no, it's the obstacle of simply we are trying to take the male principle. And so of all aspects that the male can enjoy, because male means they enjoy anything, any aspect of sense gratification, women is the top. Right? Therefore, because of its intimacy, its depth is the most. So therefore, all means that's what you see. Shantaras is the least intimate. You just appreciate. There's no contact. Servitorship, then you get a little closer. You may serve in that, but it's very formal. So you may even touch the person's body, but it's formal. Friendship, then that formality is dropped, but it's not so intimate. You give a hug or this or that. It's very quick. But parental ras, then it's deeper than that. It's more intimate. Like that. Conjugal ras goes more intimate than that. So therefore we can see is the ras is considered higher simply because it's in the intimacy that's there. So, yeah. So that's simply what's trying to be obtained in that field, is intimacy. So for the women, it's just intimacy. The man is sense gratification. Yeah. 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 Means that means that area, but I'm not sure exactly where it is. But like that Dravidian culture, the Dravidians are actually fallen Kshatriyas, according to Mano. They were a group of Kshatriyas that fell from their duties. That's why you see they're actually so. I mean, when it comes to fighting, you don't want to mess with them. It means it's like you see, you have the trouble in Lanka is Dravidians. The local government there can't do anything about it, and the Indian government taking their army there can do nothing about it. They have those dacoits that live in the forests there, and they steal all the stuff, and they can't do anything about it. They're just so vicious like that. Also, Kashas, the Orientals, they're fallen Kshatriyas also. That's why you see that in their culture that martial arts and all that's so prominent, and they're very, very, you know, when you think of torture, you think of the Chinese, you know, like that. Because of that, that's there in the nature. So, like you said, there's more anger, more passion is there. And all that. Yes. Yes. What is the function of the mind when the senses come to the transcendental platform? It basically becomes the seat of spontaneous. It becomes the seat of the spontaneous devotional service because its function is still accepting and rejecting. So it will accept those things that are favorable for service, and it will either, for those in Vaikuntha, it will accept according to the platform of rules and regulations of the Vaikuntha worship, and so it'll just move from one to the next like that. So there's always some spontaneity, but then in Braj, then it's purely spontaneous. But that's where the desire arises. Desire and attachment arise in the mind. When that arises, then the intelligence will be applied to perform the activity, you know. So the activity is actually the most important, because that's what then gives the pleasure to Krishna. It's the activity. Because the taste is what's tasted, but that taste is enhanced through activity. Just like, let's say, Krishna, he has great affection for the residents of Vrindavan. And they have affection for him. So they can taste that affection just by being themselves and thinking about that person. But when they interact, then you increase that. Therefore, Abhideya becomes the most important. That's why Rupa Goswami is prominent for us. Right? He is the Acharya. Right? Because his deity is Govinda, who is the Abhideya deity. Gopinath isn't our main deity. Right? Like that. Govindaji is. Because it's the love is there, but that love increases through activity. So therefore, the activity is the most important. And that activity then is based on a relationship, therefore Madan Mohan. You know, so that's there. So that's why those two acharyas become more prominent for us. Because we don't have that love. Is by through Sanatana Goswami, then we understand our relationship with Krishna. Then we will perform the activities that will then result in giving us love of Godhead. Then on that platform, then it will come back to Govindji as the transcendental, transcendentally inspired activities. Because of the love, then we'll perform activities. Because otherwise, tasting, Krishna is Atmarama, so he already tastes. But to expand that, therefore there's activity. He expands everything because the devotees are already there. Everything's already there. He tastes it, but he's not interacting with it. So when he manifests it, that's when he interacts with it. And then that happiness is there. It increases. So the mind then becomes the point of that experience of that transcendental rasa. Rasa's experienced or tasted in the mind. That's why the mind is actually the central focus of what we're trying to get at. Because of its tasting material rasa, therefore it doesn't really have interest in spiritual rasa. It's satisfied. When we run into obstacles in this material rasa, then it gets jarred loose enough that then we can start to put in, you know, intelligence, and we can intellectualize the material rasa. That breaks down our faith in it. By breaking down that faith in it, then we tend to doubt it. And when we doubt it, then there's room for replacing it with spiritual. But as long as that great faith is there, then why will one move forward? That's why it's windows that you get. The person's going along and he gets so frustrated, that's a window for Krishna consciousness. Yeah, they're tasting separate. But the mind then is spiritual mind, so it can still hold all 11 of them together. I mean, all 10 of them together. It can still hold it together because it's spiritual mind. And the material platform, the material mind can't do it like that, because material mind is dull, so the material senses are dull, so they work together. But the spiritualized senses then have to be in contact with spiritualized mind. Then the spiritual senses have to be with the spiritual mind. Yes, thinking, feeling, willing, that's still there. You think about Krishna, you have that love for Krishna, then desire to serve Krishna. Intelligence is there, but it's spiritual. You know, means it just, intelligence simply discriminates. It doesn't make a choice. See, that's the thing, is the intelligence discriminates between various things. It discriminates that there's a difference between things, or it finds the commonality. Right? That's all it does. And the mind, all it does is between that, accept what has been broken apart or put together, or reject what has been broken apart or put together. So that way the two of them work together. And that's all depending upon what you're going to accept and reject depends upon your ego. So depending upon your rasa with Krishna, then you will therefore then break things apart or put things together based on that, and accept and reject based on that. That's why ego is so important. So our identity in the material world, the more we're fixed in our material identity, the more we're stuck here. That's why you see the biggest materialists have the biggest ego. Because their identity, even if they're humble, they have some good character, their identity is fixed. You know, the guy who becomes the big, huge, you know, whatever it is, you know, wealthy or powerful or intellectual, from a little kid, they know where they're going. They know who they are. That's one of the common things they've done in the survey of people who are, you know, what we'll consider as successful in the material world. From a young age, they knew where they were going. It's because their identity was focused. If the identity is focused, then the intelligence and the mind can function clearly. Otherwise, then they're all over the place. They can't function. You won't get a good result. You know? So that's the whole point, is that you change that identity from I am this body to I am Krishna's servant. If that's attained, then the spiritual mind and spiritual intelligence can function. But until that's changed, they can't. So to that degree that you change that identity, to that degree they can also change. So as the ego becomes spiritualized, and the mind and sense, mind, intelligence, and senses become spiritualized. Which one? Intelligence. Oh, it'll come from the super soul, but it's according to our karma. That is coming, I would say, from chit. It's coming from the chit potency, which we are. We're expanded from there. But that will come through the devotees. That's why that premanjana chudita bhakti vilochane, it means that the living entities become vitalized and spiritualized through coming that energy coming from Radharani. So if one is her assistant or friend, then it's directly from her in that form. If not, then it'll be through whatever the particular internal potency is manifest. Like in Vaikuntha, it will be through Lakshmi. You know, and then through Lakshmi, it'll come down to Vishwakshena and Garuda, Hanuman, like these kind of personalities. Huh? Yogamaya. Yeah, Yogamaya is also said to be chit potency. Yeah. That's the whole. Means the earlier that the ego can be changed, the better. But the problem is the ego is such as that you work with it in many ways. You have to work with it pleasantly so that the person has trust in this and that. But sometimes to break certain things, sometimes strength has to be used, harshness. That's why you see is that women can create women. because amongst themselves in their own culture, they're very straightforward. They don't mind saying exactly what they say, so they can break ego of women themselves. But the ego of men, they can't. They can hurt it, but they can't change it. That's why it takes men to break the ego of men. But to break the ego of women, you're using emotion. You know, it's an emotionally stated point for an emotional situation, and that then creates an awareness in the girl of either gain or loss, and so then with time she chooses the right one, you know, meaning she gives up her mental concoction. But for men, because their ego is functioning, their ego is not mine or mind, it's I, so it's intelligence. So therefore it has to be broken outside of the sentimental field or the mind field of the mind. That's why men working with training boys and women training girls are separated. You know, because the men will think, oh, you should be like this, and the women will think you should be like that. That's always there. The greatest difficulty in training men is women. Because the method to be used and the unsentimental making the point, women can't handle. If they trust the men that are involved, then they're kind of okay. It has to be done. But there's no question that they'll ever, in eternity, understand. Just like men will never understand women. It's an eternal principle. Prabhupada makes that point. Man can't understand woman, woman can't understand man. But through duties and devotional service, you can make a compatible platform by which they can function together, you know, in a progressive way. But as far as understanding, no question. No question. So that's why the methods are different. You know, the woman's ego is dealt with through emotion. The man's ego is dealt with through lack of emotion, just pure intellectualizing on a point. And that cracks it. Because he may have had some emotional, mentally concocted idea about it, and then you pull it back in its pure, stark form, then he loses that interest in that. But the women, you take that away, they're finished. They're like the inchworm has to move from one experience to another. So you want to create renunciation in a woman, she has to have her facilities and sense gratification that she's in. And then gradually, when she gets the taste for renunciation, she'll pick this foot up. Man will just throw himself into it. And if by good association he gains that renunciation and gains the taste, he can stay there. And if he doesn't, he'll go back. Therefore, you say the man falls down. You don't talk about women falling down. You know, because it's just a different field. So man can do that, women can't. It's just different. Just like in that emotional field, the man doesn't think. The woman has to do the thinking. Right? That's the point. Is the Yeah. Like that. So always these things. That's the nice thing about it. See, it's like if it was so easily understandable, everyone would have figured it out a long time ago and we'd be bored. Right? So Krishna's made it so complex, it can never be figured out. And therefore, then people go on and on and on. You can only become frustrated with it. You can't figure it out. You can figure it out enough to understand that it won't work, but you can never actually analyze it down to the last thing. No, it just doesn't happen. You know, it's enough to figure out this is, you know, it's just, yeah. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, Shiva Parvati as close as you get, and Shiva said he still can't. I told that story, though. He can't figure it out. And she's his energy. He still can't figure it out. If he works within that, if he works within tattva, of course he can understand. But the point is tattva is not the point. Tattva is not the point of bewilderment between man and woman. Some are bewildered more because they don't know it. The one who knows the tattva of men and knows the women and how they interact, and that makes the rasa more workable. But on the platform of rasa, it can never, never, never be understood. Right? You know, on tattva, you know, okay, that women will be, they'll be fickle. But why it's fickle, that you'll never know. From one moment to the next, going along, the woman's going, oh, tell me about this, tell me about that, and it's getting more and more intimate, you're revealing more and more, it's getting more and more deep, the taste is getting deeper and deeper, and then you reveal something that, bang, it's gone. You know, then the mood goes, and he said that, and that was this person, or that situation, or it throws a doubt, well, maybe this will happen, or that will happen, and then finish, you know, what happened? The man's going, what happened? We were just going a nice, progressive, straight line, and now it's out in left field, and it takes days for it to get back together. And he can't figure out what happened. But in the woman's field, all it did was move from one intense emotion to another intense emotion, so the intensity stayed the same. For the man, it stopped. It went from intense back to zero. Right? Like that. Unless he wants to get into the anxiety that's there of trying to figure out what's going on and what, like that, you know, was it my fault or this or that, right? Because that's the thing. So the woman, because it's the sharing of experience, so now that intimacy was shared. Now she's upset, so now she'll spin doctor the whole thing to make it that now it's the man's fault. And so, and the intensity still remains. So woman's tasting the same intensity. She's just going on in the progressive thing, getting deeper and deeper of intensity with this man. But it's going all over the place, like that. But she's going deeper, but he can't figure out what's going on. So it can't be figured out. It's just not. It happens. If you know that it happens, therefore, Shastra says the man is tolerant. Yeah. No, it's just the field. Even this not fully understood, because man tries to understand his field. You know, it's, you know, he gets something. But most of the time, I try to figure out what's going on in the other field. And women don't try to figure it out; they experience it. If you ask them, they'll sit and analyze, and they can tell you what's going on. They think about it sometimes in a few moments, few days. They can tell you what's going on, but because experience is the main, intellectualizing on the field is not important. You know, only if they see the need that you'll get a gain out of it for going, stepping forward in Krishna consciousness, then analyzation will take place. But as long as the experiences remain, that's the whole point. Women dry up if the experience is not good, or if there's no experience. You know, that's the thing, is that you see in the family life, then it means that there's a certain amount of interaction has to be there to make it function. Otherwise, the experience is not there. So one has to, expertise in grihastha life is to figure out how experience is gained for both parties. At the same time, is there Krishna conscious sadhana and activities and association is not compromised. Is that a sign? I say, I'm just thinking, hey, wait a minute. Does that make? Yeah, so it's that's the whole field. It's a science. But science has its limit. Yeah. No, there has to be but the point is that attraction should still be based on knowledge. One has to know that actually, the wife is not beautiful. But it's only because he still has some idea that it is, then he's there in the beginning. And because he is attracted, therefore he goes out of his way to please her. But that's why duty is so important. Because even when he comes to the point of realizing that she is not, the beauty is nothing, still he has his duties towards her. And so he will perform the activities that he would have done because of his material attraction for her. Therefore, her needs are taken care of. Therefore, she will be at her best and will be her, you know, mundane, beautiful best. Right? Because it's said, when the women are radiant in the house is happy. And when the women aren't radiant, then, you know, there's no words to describe, you know, hell, more hell, most hell. Like that. That's the... Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it goes between hello and oh, hell. Yeah, like that. So it's the same kind of principle, you know. Hello. What are you so happy about? Oh, hell. Okay, so then you know how to. So that's the thing. So when they're radiant, and that is done seemingly because of attraction. But in the beginning it may be attraction, but it should be that one knows duties. Otherwise attraction goes. And when attraction goes, then it doesn't function. So that's why in Indian marriages, the wife can be 200 kilos, and husband and wife go on perfectly serving together. In fact, it's better than it was when they're more intimate. They know more what to do and how to help each other. So that goes away. It means the drive of that material attraction is 6 months. That's on a favorable conditions. Like that. So unless one knows duties, attachment will keep it for a little longer. Attraction goes 6 months. Attachment will keep it longer, that supposedly I can get what I want emotionally and sensually out of this. But attachment also may go at one point and go from this girl and decide when attraction comes to another girl, then he'll transfer that attachment over there also. Because attachment follows attraction. That's why you see the women work so much on attraction. Because if you're attracted, then attachment will remain. But the Vedic thing is based on duties. If duties are there, then attachment remains even though attraction's not there. Yeah, because then it's servant. So therefore, activity is favorable. Right? So that attachment then, instead of being mundane, becomes that it's a person you can work with very nicely. It's just like, let's say you have a service to do, okay, and it takes more than one person. You got, let's say, maha cleaning, okay, and you're going to do this. So naturally the thing is you're going to think, who do you work the best with and have the least problem? And then you'll choose, hey, can I work with them to clean the bathrooms or do whatever. So here you have a person that you know so well, so intimately, then you can serve together very nicely. So it's naturally a very favorable platform to perform devotional service. But that's the platform she'd be functioning from, not because the guy's all gaga about her beauty, because how long will it last? You know, a guy's a millionaire, okay, maybe he can keep going a few more years, after the, 200th, facelift and, lipo and all these other things that they got to do, So then, it gets a bit of a problem. Does that make sense? Yeah, brings the men, brings the women also. Means commitment is the most important. But there, if the man is there, women will reciprocate, because it's always based on justice, right? That's where economics, justice, that's the main platform. You find the ones that generally jump up and down about justice the most or morality are women, and men attached to women. Like that. Like you'll see, the brahmacharis, the sannyasis, are more liberal about people having sensual difficulties. But they will be more heavy about, philosophy differences. They'll come down a ton of bricks on someone on that, but on the other is they know it happens. But you'll find women and those attached to women, it's the opposite. Philosophically, the guy can be off as long as he's morally nice. But if any moral things happen, it doesn't matter. What else is there? He's out. Unless you can find another thing of sentiment to connect it to. Ashwatthama killed Draupadi's children. She wants to take her bath standing on his head. Right? So then Arjuna, goes off with that mission. So when he brings the guy back, then it's, but he's the son of the teacher. So that relationship is there. Right? Before, it's he's the killer of my children, so my relationship with him is my feet on his head when I take a bath. Right? Then it switches to, but he is the son of our teacher, so therefore then he's respected. So it's changed from one rasa to another, so it's okay. Therefore Arjuna's sitting there going, what's going on? She wants the guy's head on a platter, and now he says, no, don't kill him. Right? And then it gets completely spun, because then Krishna says, okay, now you got to please, Bhima and Bhima and myself on one side, and Yudhishthira and Draupadi on the other. But the only reason Bhima was so fired up because Draupadi was fired up. And the only reason Arjuna went out and got Ashwatthama is because Draupadi was fired up. Yudhishthira all along said, don't bother. You know? And now Krishna's having fun because Draupadi switched, and now he's going, now he's, you know, make it strong. Now Bhima wants. Because if he just says, I want, then it's kind of like, hey, you know, like that, you're God. Why you get involved in this like that? But you know, Bhima and I, you know, want to see like that. You know, so they have fun, you know, Krishna has fun in this. So only Krishna, because he is male, he has fun with variety. Because he's God, everything works the way he wants. So in one sense, even though there's an unlimited variety, it's all known. The end limit of everything, he's in every atom, between every atom. Right? So therefore, there's nothing that's not there. You know, it's like you go, okay, you take the girl, okay, now of the girl, her face is nice. Okay, of her face, her eyes are nice. Okay, of the eyes, then let's say your eyebrows and of that, then that's made of hairs. Hairs are the, you know, how you say, the it means when everything in the body, when it builds itself, it gives off a waste product. So hair is the waste product of the bones, like that. So that's there. Then you get into the bones, and that's made out of these particular minerals and that. Those minerals are made out of these molecules, those out of these atoms. And, you know, and Krishna's inside those. So where's the fun for Krishna? You know? So for him, therefore, the variety that's caused by Yoga Maya, that becomes fun for him. Right? So that variety for him is fun because he is the enjoyer. He is the controller. But the living entity is simply trying to be God. So all these variety creates frustration in him being God and being the enjoyer. So that's why the living entity suffers so much. God doesn't suffer so much. Like that. Whether he's with the gopis or separated from, he enjoys in both things. You know, market goes up or market goes down, he makes money. Like that. But we, it's when the market's going up, we think, okay, I'm on a roll, you know. You know, when you're hot, you're hot. And then when the market goes down, it's like, hey, what happened, you know? yeah, then you go down, right? You know. So that's the whole difficulty, is that we're not God. So women are meant for God. Only God can handle them, like that. So therefore, only a God-conscious husband can handle, you know, women. Like that. That means sense control, this and that. Because Krishna is the most renounced. Therefore, all women are attracted to him. You know, the man who's completely enamored by women, no women are attracted to. Like that. And Krishna, who is completely detached from everything to the maximum, all women are attracted to. So that's why in the Vedic culture, without brahmacharya, you don't have a grihastha. Bring that grihastha who thinks he's one who wasn't a brahmacharya. And we'll point out how his wife has got him wound around his finger. He won't understand it, but I guarantee you, the whole room full of women will. Guaranteed. There's no question of a man who didn't have some time away from women, was trained away from women by men. Whether it was, even he wasn't a brahmachari, whether he went out hunting with his father, was out on the battlefield, he went to the army, he went to something. Without that, he is not a man who is in control of women. He's a clown, but women are so clever, they let the clown think he's in charge. That's the way it goes. And there's no exception. There's not one exception. It doesn't matter who you are, there's no exception. Yeah, that's why the men are separately educated. Because otherwise, there's no question. There has to be some time. It can be short, it can be long, but the result has to be gained. Like we see the Kshatriyas, they might at an early age graduate to take up, you know, managing the kingdom. So in the Vedic ages, they would graduate at 16. You know, unless they're going for like really spiritual. But if they're just going to Gurukul long enough to be a king, they'll graduate at 16 and get married. And then like Abhimanyu, he was married at 16. 8 months later, he was dead. Like that. But at 16, he was a full-fledged Kshatriya on the battlefield, fully trained. But he was a man. So in that short time, the intensity was so much, he was a man. Like that. So it doesn't matter the time length, but it has to, the effect has to be there. You know? So that's the principle. So some experience has to have created that. Otherwise, there's no question. That man who thinks he is without it, or those men who say, ah, they're going to get married anyway, what do we, why bother with this brahmacharya life? That man's a fool, number one. He may not be a first-class brahmacharya, he's a first-class fool. Because that's what Prabhupada said. Yeah, that's all. The women just anything. You know, he talks big, but just the women just say, oh, this, oh, I got a headache. You know, finished. Like that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they all think, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, therefore the next point he makes here. As such in transcendental ecstasy, is it here? Oh, no, it's in a different one. Oh, okay. Yeah, all the above different stages are but different stages of development of transcendental love. He's talking about the nine levels of being so surcharged of transcendental love, there comes a strong feeling of separation which leads to eight different kinds of ecstasies. So that's the next stage, all these ecstasies. That's why it becomes, that's why the material body can't handle it. See, in the material world, what the mind does is that the senses are always pulling in information. I mean, unlimited amounts. I think they did some kind of analysis. It's something like 40,000 bits of information either come in every second or every minute. I'm not sure which, but whatever, it's a lot in either case. So then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, so that's all they know about it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes the five stages that it goes through. The first is that the senses pull in information. So the mind is aware of all that. So the mind actually is tuned into all that comes in. That's why sometimes there's something that happens and you wonder how, and it seems like it's mystical or something. How did he know? Because the mind already has caught everything. You know, we can hear the bird out there, the things going, the cow, the thing on the road, the train in Navadvip. But what it does to the second one is then it reduces it down to what is important at the time. Like right now, the conversation is important for the mind. That's what it values. So it cuts out all everything else. So that's the second stage. The third stage, it accesses the memory, which is part of intelligence. That's where the mind and the intelligence work together. So in that platform, then it pulls out what is previous experience of this, because the mind only functions by experience. So was the experience good, then it continues. If it was bad, then it cuts it off. So then the next thing is then the mind makes a decision. The fourth stage, it accepts or rejects. The fifth is then it engages the senses to do the bidding. So therefore, means your thinking part comes in the first three. Your feeling comes in the fourth. And then your willing is the fifth. So that's how the mind will function. So then what happens on the transcendental is that they can all function fully. So then the mind, it's that they can all be happening at once. So that's another difference why transcendental ecstasy can't be explained, because we only know how to focus on one thing at a time. You know? Like that. And so that's why also there's that difference in before. This would explain also technically the difference in the male and female psychology on this. Is the male is that I'm going to get sense gratification by this line of activities. And so as that gets more and more intense, then it's great. The woman's is just experience, intensity of experience. So for the, you know, it's just like, how you say? The man is there, then there, and then you know, something comes up, the phone rings, for him that's a stop and an obstacle in it. You know, and then if that let's say the child cries or something, then for the mother it just switches from this intensity of interaction to that intensity of interaction. So for her, very cleanly she moves from one to the next. And then the man just sits there. Because it's just his movement of experience stopped. But the woman's didn't. It just moved from one to the next. So unless the man comes where he's not interested in sense gratification, therefore, for him, then it just moves from one. He can accommodate it. But if he's attached to the senses, he can't function. Like that. The more he's attached, the more he will find the association of women or trying to fulfill one's desires frustrated. And the more he's detached, then the more comes. But because you're detached, you have nothing to gain from it. Right? So that's the whole point. Like Sukadeva Goswami, he's fully detached. He's youthful. He's naked. The girls are youthful. They're naked. But there's nothing to gain there. He just goes by. So he had, and they're there. They're standing there. They're not covering up. If he wants to look, he could look. But as soon as he looks, they'll cover. He doesn't look, they don't cover. So that's a whole other topic. That's the jiva. You know, that's energy. That's shakti, how it functions. So that's why also materially you can't enjoy. Only because Krishna's enjoyed, because he is the enjoyer. Then we can enjoy. We can't directly enjoy anything. Even our senses. Krishna, because he sees it, therefore we can see it and get happiness. That's the universal form. When he desires to taste, therefore the tongue and taste comes into, and water comes into play. All those things get created because he desires to taste. So only because he tastes, then we can taste. Only because he sees, we can see. So that's what's pious and impious. What he likes to see and what he doesn't like to see. What he likes to taste, what he doesn't like to taste. So since it's a universal form, he is tasting, he is seeing, he is doing. Therefore, what he likes to do, then that's where it categorizes. So pious means it keeps you in progressive human life. Impious means it drops you into animal life. Because the animals are doing it. You know, okay, you're eating garbage. Okay, pious human doesn't eat it, animals do. So therefore, then your sense changed, so then you are an animal. So therefore, the universal form of the animal, then that expansion, then that's what matches. So therefore, then the animal tastes through the taste the Lord has that's expanding in the universal form as the animal. But as human, if we're going to do as human, then it has to be the human forms. So that's actually pious and impious, is that it pleases the Lord. Because our senses are actually only functioning through his senses. We're not the doers like that. But because we think we are, then the result comes to us. Like that. That's why if you're detached, more comes. Because Krishna's detached, so he has everything. He's the most detached, he has the cosmic creation. You know? So like that. So detachment means more. Like that. Yeah, it means there's a non-difference. That's why they're same and difference. Tattva, they're difference. Rasa, they're the same. That's why our philosophy, Chinta Beda Beda Tattva. If some deal with tattva, don't deal with rasa. Some deal with rasa, not with tattva. We deal with them both at the same time. You know. So that's the thing, is that they can function at the same. It means when you get right up into tasting rasa, then tattva is put on the side. But the point is we can see the two in each other. Rasa is tasted by the material senses, but not the transcendental. The mind can taste it, but the tongue can't. So when you have a spiritual tongue that can, then you can imagine that the experience will be unlimitedly greater. Here it's the mind by concoction has decided. So you're overlaying something on something. It's not actually real. But the spiritual tongue is real, and Krishna or whatever it is real. So to taste that is real. So then you have Krishna who's real, the tongue who's real, and the mind who's real, and all that, and so then you have something here. But here it's the object is dead matter, your tongue's dead matter, your mind is dead matter, but because you identify with it, you accept its concoction that you're going to be happy by tasting this. Yeah. So then, therefore, it's only because you say it's good. You don't say it's good, it's not good. You know? Yeah, like that. Yeah. So then when the soul understands that it's only through Krishna anyway that we're tasting, material or spiritual, why go for the inferior? You know, it's just like this. I'm thinking, yes, it's my 2 rupees, I'm enjoying everything, 2 rupees and all that. But when you figure out, well, it's not your 2 rupees, actually it's the government's 2 rupees. The government has unlimited rupees. So then why would you identify with the 2 rupees of the government instead of the unlimited of the government? So that's the choice. Is we either identify with our own senses and the taste that's there, and therefore, to that degree of our piety, then more or less, you know, of this second grade sense gratification comes through. Or you connect with Krishna who's unlimited, therefore the taste is unlimited. In fact, he is God, tastes less than the living entity tastes as Shakti. Because he is male. Therefore, the element of Sarvagya is there for him. So he can move in and out of knowledge or mukdata, which is just rasa. But the Shakti is just experience. Right? So it's so much more. Right? That's why it's the man looks at it, comes to the house, nice house, and the woman's all in ecstasy. Or the man tastes it, good, and the woman, wow, this is, you know, the man touches the woman, it's okay, and the woman's in it, like this. It's just everything's just more. So that's the whole point, is that Shakti, the experience is more for Shakti than Shaktiman. So actually, if we really want to be the enjoyer, we should become Shakti. But in the material world, the material woman is empowered with the Purusha Shakti. So she's also trying to be man. She's also trying to be the enjoyer. But she's doing it through the medium of the feminine culture. But still, she's trying to control in that way. Well, in the spiritual world, the women are women, the men are men. You know, it means all the devotees are women. So they are actually Shakti. And Krishna is Shaktiman. Well, here it's all mixed. So you can't really get any taste out of it. Yeah. So perverted reflection, in that it looks the same. And if you follow the scripture, it looks the same, it acts the same, results are the same, but you don't get the same taste because one is inferior and the other is spirit. Then if you don't follow the scriptures, then it's a perversion of the perversion. Yeah, the material world is dull, but as long as we have faith in it, we'll have it. That's the importance of association. You know, these festivals, that's why Samkirtana is so important, especially in this age. Because everything's so dull, and our expectations are very dull. You know, that's all. It's so dull that the only way to overcome it is by a greater taste. And you overcome the greater taste by doing Krishna consciousness together. You sit and chant japa or have a little kirtan with yourself, it's nice, you'll be happy. But if you do it with other devotees and everybody's, you know, in the same mood, then that experience will always overwhelm. So one has to expose oneself as much as possible to the transcendental experience. And that will then, with time, overwhelm the desire for the material experience. Because you have to replace it. We are Shakti, so we have to put the foot down on the other side only when we're sure that it's there, then we'll lift up this side. That's why the example is given. So that's why the example there, generally we take it to the living entity. right? Means you, by tasting a higher taste, you give up the lower taste. So therefore, it's like the inchworm. I applied it to women, right? Because that's the psychology. But you have to look at it as we, as jivas, are women. That's why that example works for any jiva. That's in tattva, right? But in the particular rasa, it applies in women. It applies in men also, just that they will make that thing, they'll either go up or go back. But there, it's, they won't give up the one until the other one is firmly planted. Right? Then this will be moved to here. Like that. So it's... yes, sir? Function of the heart. The heart is the emotions. That is the mind. Means the emotions, the mind, the heart. That's values. That's all one thing. It may have different aspects how you approach it, but it's one item. Just like you take the table. It's one item, but we can approach it from its aesthetic value. We can approach it from its functional value. We can approach it from its construction, how to construct such a table. We can take it from, how it'll function in the weather, or what it's made out, what word, you know, what wood it's made out of, like this. And then it has all kinds of branches, how to grow that wood, or how to, you know what I'm saying? Like that. So it's all one thing. The heart, the mind, the emotions, the values, that's one thing. Like that. That all goes together. Because what you value is what is in your heart, right? What you value is what your where your emotions go. Where your emotions go is where what you value. You know, you value your child, therefore your emotions go there. You don't value someone else's; it doesn't go there. You value children in general, therefore it'll go out to any child. So it'll accept and reject based on that. So that's the mind, like that. Okay, that's why attachment. Attraction, attachment, you know, making that endeavor, that's all the mind. That's why the intelligence, if it's there, then we can change our value system. Right now our value system is materially motivated. You change it to where it's not materially motivated. Then you change the value system, you change what you are attracted to and what you're attached to, therefore what you do. Like that. So that's actually what you're trying to get it at in the whole process is the mind. Because as it says, the mind is your greatest friend or your greatest enemy. You catch the mind, you're Krishna conscious. You don't have the mind, you're not Krishna conscious. So therefore all these tools of intelligence and engaging the body, it's all to deal with the mind. The ego is to catch the mind. Because the mind is the central ego. Means the grossest ego... means the external ego is my external identity and my body. Right? These are two halves. Means the false ego, right, is one of the elements. Its manifestation is the gross body made out of the five elements. Right? So that's the biggest. I mean, that's on the outside. Then below, that's the intelligence, which then gross manifestation is the senses. Then in the middle is the mind. So all these you're working at to get to the mind at the middle. And in the core of the mind is that I am the enjoyer. So if you can change that, then you're Krishna conscious. So these are all the four levels of false ego. Is the what we'd call ego and body. Then the intelligence and senses. Then there's the mind, and you know, it means of what your value system is. Then there's the actual principle on which the mind is functioning, is that I'm the controller and enjoyer, therefore I'm God. You change that, you change all the others. So that's why the mind is the central. You know? And when we're dealing in these ways, therefore we analyze it from that side. Because it takes the fun out of it. You know, like if we talk about the heart, then it's emotion. So it takes it into a different realm. So if we want to enhance that, then we'll use that. We want to bring out that the aspect of the heart is important. Then we'll use that term. Just like, let's say, the Vaishnav, you know, they have a very soft heart. Therefore, they're very compassionate and kind to other living entities. So because that's good, that's based on a transcendental thing, Therefore, we use that terminology. But where that and that attachment and that thing is based on spiritual. So it's good. So we use those terminologies, more emotional terminologies. So they become attractive, and then we take them. But when we're trying to break that, then it's we have a soft heart towards our mundane attachments. Therefore, we take it back into simply values and accepting and rejecting and the mind and like that. Then we take it from that aspect, more from tattva than from rasa. So then that breaks our attachment for it. But at the same time, you have to be replacing it with the Vaishnava culture and endeavor. See, that's the difficulty one may run into, is that one takes up Krishna conscious philosophy, but not Krishna conscious culture. So because of that, there's no taste. So then what happens without the culture, at some point one goes back to one's original culture. One will go back to one's mundane culture. Yeah, because you have to have a taste. So then you have this problem, is you have Krishna conscious philosophy, mundane culture. Right? And because you've gone back to it, the mundane culture has more prominence than the philosophy. Then you can't use the point Prabhupada says. You don't have to change your position. You don't have to make any mental adjustment. Nothing. You just chant Hare Krishna. But you're not in that position because you have made a mental adjustment that this is more important than that. The person who's coming in contact doesn't make that. He goes, oh, hey, this is nice. He's just attracted. He hasn't intellectualized on it. Nothing. This is nice. He doesn't have to change the position. He'll chant. He'll take prasad. He comes to the temple in his three-piece suit. He goes to his job. But whenever he's got time, he's thinking about Krishna and the chanting. When he's, you know, got extra time, he does it. Whenever he can, he comes to the temple. He gives his money. But the devotee who's reverted back to his culture, then he has a philosophy about that. That this is important. Oh, we tried that. Been there, done that. And so they're like the man who's awake, who pretends he's asleep. You can't wake him up. Because they have an agenda. So it's different. So therefore, then, you know, trust has to be built. You have to use all these nice sentimental terms. But unless you know how you're using it, if you use the modern system, you only make it worse. Right? The more we see that these things are used on the Vaishnava community, the more we see the community splits. And the more you see, you just go back to, you know, down home, you know, Hare Krishna, you know, fired up and drive and hey, you know, let's get out there. The more the community pulls together. Now, if you can add to that the understanding of Vedic psychology, how to keep everyone there when their mundane sentiments come up and have to be addressed, then you're going to be progressive. But the Western, they can't. They don't know what they're dealing with. They don't know what the mind is, how they'll deal with it. You don't know what a potato is, how you're going to cook it. Yes, you know, you just sit there and you just feel that it should turn into French fries, you know, and it'll, because it you know, the interaction, it'll just do it. It won't happen. You have to know what a French fry is, and you have to know how to cut it up, and you have to know how to cook. You know, it just won't happen. So therefore, they talk about it, and they help to some degree in the beginning, but in the long run, you have to see did they actually help. If someone's sick, yes, then modern psychology can help, because modern psychology is based on sick people. But if people aren't sick, it won't work, right? Because that's how it's done. Freud watched crazy people. He didn't study sane people. So therefore, if someone's insane, then you might get some benefit. But once they become sane, then what do you do with them? The problem still remains. They don't have a culture. So unless you can give them a culture for their mind, value system for their mind, that association of devotees is valuable, you know, temple programs valuable, studying, reading, preaching is valuable, you know, like that, you know, then what are you going to do? Then you have to do something. You have to go somewhere. You have to talk to somebody. You have to socialize. So then you'll socialize on the mundane platform. You have to have some kind of a festival. Then you'll have a festival, but a Western festival. You know, you have a birthday party, you'll have a rave, you'll have something. You know? Because you don't have anything to replace it with. So that's the thing, is that if those are important, then it's nice. If they're not, then it won't. So that's the whole point. Why Prabhupada makes the point is he's giving us the culture. You see, when Prabhupada was here, we, you know, dramas were a normal part of most temples functioning. They were into bhajans, learning mridanga. Prabhupada was trying to get these people who knew mridanga, take them to the West, teach them how to learn mridanga. He was teaching cooking. He was teaching all arts and culture. He was teaching how to dress, how to do, how to speak, how to walk, how to interact with people. All the culture is being taught with the philosophy. Now anybody talks about it? You know? No. I mean, if the for the temple menu, if they have popcorn and dal for lunch, no one blinks an eye. It just is normal. I mean, someone will make a comment if, you know, they took the hot popcorn, as soon as they popped it, dumped it into the plastic garbage sack, and so it got the flavor of the popcorn. Then they'll complain. You know, then they should have known better and just dumped it into the big plastic, you know, what do you call it, you know, drum instead of into the bag. Then no one will complain. But the idea of, you know, the Vaishnav menu, the Vaishnav dress, the Vaishnav music, the Vaishnav, that's, nowadays, it's not a topic of discussion. Not at all. I haven't heard it. I haven't heard it. From the GBC level down to, you know, administrative meetings to the general topic of devotees. I don't hear it anymore. I used to always hear it. Now you don't hear it. And what do I see? You see Western culture. That's all. That's it. It's just culture has to be there. So then the choice is just which one you pick. That's all. So that's the thing. That's the idea, is that you want to catch the mind. Because we have attachments to this, therefore it's important. We don't have attachments, it's not important. We have no material attachments. You don't have to that's why it says you don't have to follow any of the rules of the culture here. You know, you can go around as an avidhut and not bother what you do. Because you're absorbed in the culture of the spiritual world. Because rasa is tasted in culture, not in tattva. Like that. Krishna is God, I am his servant. Then someone who's intellectual will get a taste out of that. Okay, you know, hey, that's, you know. So that gives a taste to the intellect. But the actual taste of God is who he is, and we are who we are, and we're servant of him, then by rendering service, that's where we get the taste. And that service is rendered through what? What do? We cook something for Krishna, right? According to what? The culture. We dress according to the culture. We sing and we dance according to the culture, right? You know, I probably had mentioned about, you know, one time he was laughing. I think it was Rath Yatra. May have been Rath Yatra or a big kirtan, one of those where everybody was there, like L.A. or New York or something. And then Prabhupada was laughing. The voice asked, why is he laughing? He says, because Narad Muni came to see the Malechas dance. Because, you know, they don't follow any of these, like, you know, one fun is that just Prabhupada got them all to dance, but two, how they dance. Yeah, so, fun. Yeah, so he came to see. You know, it's like that. It was very, I don't know, in those days you used to do all kinds of funny dances, you know. Like that. Yes.
So what does it matter what you wear or what you ate,
Oh, yeah, it doesn't matter actually what you wear, what you cook or what you do, as long as it doesn't matter to you either. But if it matters to you, then it's a question of your Krishna consciousness. We say it doesn't matter means it doesn't matter. That means then today you could wear your cargo jeans, tomorrow you could wear your dhoti, the next day you could wear a burqa. You know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you could walk with shoes. It doesn't matter. But the point is at one point it comes down, it doesn't matter because it matters to us. So therefore, then we take what matters to us and engages in Krishna's service. But then, since Krishna is the one that has to accept it, it should be at least in a form that basically it's acceptable to him. Like, it doesn't matter what you cook for Krishna, so let's cook a filet mignon for him. Yeah, like, but we don't, because he won't eat it. It's a particular cut of meat. It's supposed to be very sophisticated. Yeah, but still, so therefore you can't fully say it doesn't matter. You know, the drunk could offer his, his rum. But that's the point is there's already a restriction put on it. Is that out of everything you could offer, it's restricted what you could offer because God won't accept it. But God, there's a certain basic principle. That's the minimum, that limit, that after that point God will accept it. Then there comes a point, well, what does God like? That's another stage of advancement. So that goes between Sakam and Nishkam. So that's called Aropya Siddhi, means it doesn't matter. You take whatever is valuable to you and you do it for Krishna. But then you've got to do it for Krishna. You've got to tell me that you going to the temple half-dressed is pleasing to Krishna. Because even the prostitutes in Dwarka dress better than that. And they're doing it to please Krishna, and they're prostitutes. You know? And the men, they're doing it because they like wearing whatever they like. They may or may not be doing, but it's better. Then you have to explain how walking around with your, you know, shorts, with your, you know, no t-shirt, with your fat stomach and all your pubic hair sticking out is service to Krishna. All the women are grossed out. You have to explain how that is service. You know, first I'd ask, maybe you could explain how it's culture. You know, then from culture, maybe we could go to a higher level of service. But where does it come? So it doesn't matter. So that statement then maybe have its motive is, I just want to do whatever I want to do and I don't want to be restricted by anybody. That's what I would say. For preaching, then the person says, you say, it doesn't matter, because you just chant Hare Krishna. If you chant, everything else will come. You don't worry about this, that, any of the rules. You just chant. Get attached to chanting. Get attached to the association of devotees. Get attached to taking a prasad. Everything else will come from that. Automatically, you like devotees. You want to dress like them. You want to eat like them. You want to do what they do. It'll automatically come. But if it's coming from the platform, it doesn't matter, Prabhu. Then that means it does matter very much to that person. You know, just like, we're not this body, Prabhu. That person is very much absorbed in their body. That's why the woman has to give the class, because she's in a woman's body. It's not she's giving the class because she's qualified. Her qualification is she's in a woman's body. Therefore, the person who says, we're not this body, Prabhu, therefore these rules don't apply, are the most bodily conscious. So then saying it doesn't matter, Prabhu, with the rules, is said by a person who is more attached to doing whatever they want to do, and they don't see what they do in connection to Krishna. So it's a fine line, it's consciousness. It's like what we started at the beginning of the class. It's a matter of where you put the priority. Is it the short-term goal as the priority or the long-term? If the long-term is, all the short-term automatically become dovetailed. But if the short-term aren't in line with the long-term, they may be off the path. Because short-term, you could pick unlimited ones. But short-term that are in connection with the long-term, it's limited what's there. Therefore, ultimately, it doesn't matter. But that attachment to where, you know, your tight jeans and your low-cut tank top in your house when you're just relaxing, at one point has to be addressed. You know, no pun intended. You know? But the point is that it's that has to be there. That's going to come because there's an attachment there. So that will have to be addressed. You know, you're using toilet paper. That will have to be addressed. You know, all these different things will have to be addressed at some point because you're attached to them. Prabhupada say you won't trash the one rasgula, you'll come back, let alone to a whole plethora of mundane, modern attachments. Yeah, like these. I remember once hearing some devotees like that. They were going to go out somewhere. And says, I got to go to the toilet. Says, and then they were saying, where should we go? Hey, let's use the one over the guest toilet at the temple. Says, oh, why is that? Says, there you have toilet paper. You know, then it's quick. You know, the other one's too messy, you know. But they thought it the better option. You know? So these say it's an attachment. So at one point, even the Vedic principles are an attachment that have to be given up. That's why sannyas should be at one point indifference. You don't care if you get nice food, not nice food, good clothes, not good clothes. It doesn't matter. Right? Brahmachari avoids it. Grihastha goes for it. Sannyasi doesn't matter. Because at one point it can't be it matters. Because then even that's why it says even piety has to be given up. But piety is the basic platform that you can of culture that you can function within the Vaishnava society. Sin is not a platform. You know? So that's why it's taken as a minimum. But even that eventually must be given up. That's why it's external. But we are external. And as long as we're external, it matters. And as soon as we're not external, then it doesn't matter. The whole point is on the platform of Shraddha, what you're trying to do is develop faith. But when that same person gets to the platform of Bhajana Kriya, then it does matter what he wears, how he dresses, how he talks, how he walks. But from Shraddha to Sadhu Sangha, it doesn't matter. Right? He may be in his three-piece suit all day, but if it was up to him, he'd rather dress like the devotees. But for his job and this and that, he wears that. And it may even be he has no time, so he has to wear it to the temple. But he's not. He wouldn't rather wear it. So therefore, you'll see when there's a festival or some day he doesn't have to go to work, you see him in a dhoti. But the devotee who says, it doesn't matter, Prabhu, even when he doesn't have to, he'll be in his, you know, funny outfit. Right? And Prabhupada said, if you can't dress in devotee clothes, then you dress as a fine, up-to-date gentleman, not street riffraff. So is he coming to the temple dressed as like a, you know, up-to-date, like, you know, executive? I haven't seen. One or two devotees. I think Balaram from Australia, when he'd wear karmic clothes, he'd dress like a gentleman. And one or two others, you'd see. Most dressed like riffraff. You know, it's a street culture. So there, even that, they want to dress Western, it's valuable. Okay, then bring it up to a sophisticated level at least. You want to be mundane. It's just like that, there was that, what do you call it? That story, Prabhupada said, it was a sannyasi who got married. I don't know who it was, but like that. And then Prabhupada saw the girl. And Prabhupada said, he fell down from sannyas for her? It was kind of like, this guy's got no taste. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's like, you could understand it. He was so beautiful, it just overwhelmed his senses and just blew him away. And okay, these things happen. You know, it happened to Vishwamitra, it happened to so many stories of people who just, they were so beautiful and attractive, they just bewildered their mind. But his point was like, what's happening here? So it's like, if you're going to go Western, at least be sophisticated. At least be something respectable. You know, you want to eat Western, okay, but, you know, why microwave some Maggi noodles? You know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, eat something decent. Huh? Yeah, you know, it's like it should be. You know. So that's the point, is that it should be consistent, like that. Is that okay? Yeah. I think we should. Okay. Last point, then we'll end here. So. Uh huh. How do you guarantee the end goal with children? Because they're different. Well, the thing is children you have to look at, there's a double point here. One is your end goal is to make them Krishna conscious. Otherwise, that's recommended. Otherwise, why have them? But the same time is that one is in the field where having children is part of it is because of our need or attachment to children. So therefore, that need has to be addressed in such a way that our dealings with our children both is making them Krishna conscious and removing our attachment for them so that we can become Krishna conscious. That's why over-attachment is never seen as good, because over-attachment results in the child becoming spoiled. Right? And no one will agree a spoiled child's good. And if you ask, why is a child spoiled, then the others will just say because they overindulge them, which means over-attachment. So even the gross mundane people will say that it's not good. So then one has to see is one has to deal in such a way that they're becoming Krishna conscious and we're also progressing. So it has to be both. Because just the manifestation of the emotions not enough, because unless it's done in knowledge, you won't remove it. You know, you won't remove it, because otherwise you'll do it, you have faith in it, it was either great, and so therefore you want more of it, so you have to come back to have more children, because when you're 80 years old, it's hard to have more children, unless you become, you know, the mother and father of the universe, that kind of thing, then you can expand it. But still the principle's there, next life. But then, or it doesn't go right because you don't know what you're doing, you get so frustrated, but the principle is there, so there's always a trying to get it, and then that will have to take it through the next life to continue that endeavor to fulfill. So it should be, that's why duty always comes in, is what is my duty towards my child? How am I supposed to deal? You know, what does that mean? Like the Prabhupada says, up to five, then the children are allowed to do what they like. But that's within the culture, not outside the culture. So that means is in a cultured person, they're regulated, right? That's immediately what Arjuna asks, what is the culture? And the Krishna says they're regulated, and they're eating, sleeping, mating, and recreation. Their work, excuse me, it was combined two. Eating, sleeping, work, and recreation, right? So adults are regulated in that. Kids aren't. When they eat, when they sleep, when they play, that you don't regulate them. You may try, but when they're tired, they go to sleep. When they're hungry, they eat. But that doesn't mean they break culture. I've seen parents allow their three-year-old kid to use bad language and insult senior devotees. And all the ladies just think, oh, how cute. I saw myself. And that family today still has problem holding themselves together as a family unit. They're trying really hard. You know, they're still kind of good, but the kids aren't. Kids are all off here and there. And they thought it was cute. Because then if you say no, you have to go, no, Prabhupada said let them do whatever they like. Not let them do whatever they like as an animal. Means they're a potential human being. You know, so therefore, you know, that's there. So by doing that, then therefore they'll be indulgent up to that point. So they get full attention, full time, and everything like that. But after that, then they're regulated. So whether they're at the home or they're at the school or they're whatever, they have to be regulated. So if you do that, then you'll see it'll start to break. Because in the process of regulating, then you actually find out what a kid is. You know, you just see that all it is, I remember, I think it was Sridharananda Maharaj was saying, you see a five-year-old kid, and I see a kid who 5 years ago was someone who was 90 years old. Then you actually see, you're dealing with a living entity that already has all of their desires and all that already there. So you don't, you know, who it is, you have to find out. Yeah. So they're absorbed. So it's just they're innocent. It means that they don't remember all of their what they were lusty after and greedy after and angry about and this and that. They just forgot. So that clean slate allows them to move forward progressively. But otherwise, the kid. I mean, it's just like this. If you had an adult who you brought him something to eat. He said, wow, what's this nonsense? I'm not eating that and this and that. Threw it on the floor and yelled and screamed and all that. What would you think about that guy? You'd think, wow, this is the weirdest guy I've ever met in my life. Right? But a kid can do that all day and no one will say boo. Right? So, but what's the difference? The desire in the heart is the same. So the innocence is that they don't have any samskar that they're conscious of. That will create an acceptance or rejection, especially in the major realms of sense gratification, you know, especially when it comes to interaction between man and woman, because that's the core of all other sense gratification. So that's why they have to be kept clean. You know, you turn them on to the Cosmopolitan magazine and this and that and other things like that, you have not done your duty as a parent. Because then all those samskars are in their heart. And there's every chance they want to know how to do all those things. So that's not, well, being liberal, this and that. Yeah, liberal. Liberal means non-Vedic. like that. The liberally minded Vedic sages means they find a way for you to be Krishna conscious no matter how far out in the ozone you are. That's liberal. But where liberality means it goes against Vedic principles, that's just mundane and should be understood and accepted as such. Modern means non-Vedic. Liberal means non-Vedic. So therefore it means Maya. Therefore it's demoniac. Right? For Malechas, being demoniac is normal, so therefore we don't make a big deal out of it. You know? Therefore we don't make a big deal that the Malechas are eating meat. We make a big deal, why don't you chant Hare Krishna? Then once they chant, then we can get them to stop. We don't jump up and down, oh, the dirty, smelly, you know, meat-eating, fornicating, is that? We don't worry about that. We just get them to chant. Because for them it's not a philosophy. For them it's just, you know, you breathe, you know, and you eat nonsense and you do nonsense. So they don't know that there's something else. But once you know there's something else, then it's a different story. So one has to be careful. So what it means is that one therefore does one's best to one's ability, to one's knowledge, to raise one's child in Krishna consciousness. And in doing that, one will also then lose one's taste for the need for children. But what you know is not necessarily good enough. You always have to educate yourself. Prabhupada gives the standards. If you're doing what he says, getting a result what he said, then you're doing good. But if you're doing what he said, not getting a result, or not doing what he said, then one should educate oneself. Find others who know to do. Your child's spoiled, their child's not. How do they do it? Go and ask them. You know, this guy's relationship with his wife is very nice, yours is not. Go ask him what he does. You know, like that. Or, you know, all these different things. You just figure it out. Ask, inquire, read, study, and then ask, and then put the two together. Then it comes nice. Like that. Then it's progressive. Then the child learns, the adult learns. And you do your best, because ultimately the child is an individual living entity. The choice for them to become Krishna conscious is fully in their hand. The parent can only do the best they can. But that best they can is no license for being lazy and being attached and just doing whatever you like. It means you do your duty to your best, the result's up to Krishna. Then what can you do? You know, like you see, Prabhupada did his best. His children didn't turn out great. You know? So, like that. So the point is up to Krishna. But unless we make that endeavor, then we're at fault. And then the reaction of that child will come to us. Also, it's another sobering point to keep in mind in raising the children, is until they are adult, their sinful reactions go to whoever they're dependent upon. The kid smokes dope, he doesn't get the reaction. The parent does. The kid has illicit sex, he doesn't get the reaction. The parent does. Whoever they're dependent upon, they get the reaction. Once they hit 16, then it's fully theirs. Right? But up to that time, it goes to the parents. So parents should always keep that in mind when they're very liberal towards their children, and just understand that where that reactions go somewhere. Right? So that comes from that curse of Mandukya Muni. He said that what the kids do, they don't get the reaction. It doesn't mean it disappears. They're not saints. It goes to the parents. Or if they're in the Gurukul and to the teacher, it goes to the teacher. Right? Or if they're brahmachari and the guru, it goes to the guru. The wife, it goes to the husband. The citizens, it goes to the king. Like that. So it goes somewhere. Yeah. Like that. So that's the whole thing. That's why it said putra or mutra. Right? When it comes to the men looking at it, it's seen in a more nice light. It said it's either the man's, you know, it's either the semen or the urine. So the semen creates, you know, a son. Urine is just urine. With the women, it's even heavier. It's either she gave birth to a baby or she passed stool. Like that. Like that. So, that's how it's seen in Vedic culture. So a bad child is seen in that light. Bad meaning not Krishna conscious. Or at least minimum, they should just be nice, right? Krishna says if you can't be Krishna conscious, at least be a nice, pious person, you know, at least that much. But pious means Vedic. So unless one's pious oneself, hard to get another one. Hindus create more Hindus, yeah, definitely. Because they're pious. Malechas create Malechas. Okay, we'll end here. Jai Ho. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainatai Gaura Premarandi.